This is Louisiana Considered on WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. Just ahead on today's show, New Orleans jazz singer Charmaine Neville is in the house for a chat about gospel music and its influence on her sound. But first, one of New Orleans' oldest beer brewing companies suddenly shut its doors last fall. Faubourg Brewing, formerly Dixie Beer, had deep roots in the community, and the decision to close the business's operations in the city where it's so beloved left a lot of employee and beer fans scratching their heads. It also piqued the interest of Drew Hawkins, reporter at the Gulf States Newsroom. He recently published an investigation into the decision to close Faubourg in Anti-Gravity magazine and the Louisiana Illuminator, and he joins us now with more on his findings. Hi, Drew.
Hey, Diane. So good to be here.
First, can you tell us a bit more about Faubourg? Why was it so beloved here in New Orleans?
Sure thing. So we've got to go back about 100 years to 1907 when Dixie Beer was founded here in the city. And it was this beloved brewery known across the world, essentially. But in the summer of 2020, after George Floyd was murdered by a police officer, the company decided to change the name to Faubourg so it wasn't as associated with the antebellum South.
Now, at some point, ownership of the brewery changed and a private equity company took over. Can you tell us more about that deal and who the new owner was?
Sure thing. So the Bensons are the one that own Faubourg Brewery. You know, Tom Benson had this vision of bringing beer back to the city. And they merged with this private equity company called Made by the Water, which is a beer portfolio company. They have breweries all over the South, Catawba, Palmetto, Oyster City, these small craft breweries. And so they merged with this new company, which also came with a new CEO, a guy named Alexi Sekmakis, who also happens to be the son of the company's founder.
And the company announced at the end of last year that they would be closing the New Orleans facility. What was their reasoning?
So their official reasoning that they gave to the media was that they were closing because they had problems with Entergy, they had problems with the Sewage and Water Board bill, they had a problem with a tax bill from the property assessment, they also pointed to crime in New Orleans East, and they cited an inability for the facility to meet production demand.
We are speaking with Drew Hawkins, reporter with the Gulf States Newsroom, about his recent investigation into the decision to close Faubourg Brewery in New Orleans. Now, walk us through why you felt it was important to look into some of the reasoning that Made by the Water gave for closing. What did you find?
So I talked to Dan Stein from Stein's Market in Delhi, who's kind of like the expert liaison of beer in the city. He essentially brought craft beer here. He read that report that the company gave those reasons, and he said something just doesn't line up here. Something's fishy. And I looked into it a little bit. I talked to dozens of former employees. I looked at some industry reports, and I found that basically everything that they said just was a misrepresentation. It wasn't true. Looking at internal industry sales reports, the idea that the facility couldn't meet demand is just entirely refuted by the company's sales figures. And like I mentioned, I spoke to former employees who said that crime was never an issue at the facility. These are people who were brewers that worked there. And then I also spoke with several city and utility officials, and they said that they all tried to work with the company, but the company just wouldn't listen. And this announcement was actually a surprise for them. They thought they were working together to come to some sort of solution. So basically, everything that they said was not true, which is actually par for the course for the way the company and its leadership does business both here and elsewhere.
So what does this all mean for the future of Faubourg here in New Orleans, Drew, and other local beer companies? Can I still buy a can of Faubourg beer?
Okay, I think that you'll definitely be able to still buy a can of Faubourg. It'll likely continue to be brewed here in some capacity. But the thing is that craft beer really is this niche market, right? It's not as lucrative as it was maybe even a decade ago. So the people that are still in it are people who do it because they love it. So the city's craft breweries will likely not be affected by any of this.
So what's the bottom line here?
The bottom line here, as one source I spoke to put it, is that private equity is a serial killer. This is just what it does. And it's not just happening in craft beer. I mean, you can look at hospital systems, for example. Just 5 years ago, hardly any hospitals were owned by private equity companies, but it's all over the place now. So it comes in as this, you know, capitalist cure for a company's problems. But in the end, it's what ends up killing it.
From the Gulf States Newsroom, reporter Drew Hawkins. Thanks for being here. You can read Drew's investigation in Anti-Gravity magazine and the Louisiana Illuminator. From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Diane Mack. The PBS docuseries Gospel, hosted by Harvard scholar, executive producer, and writer Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr., takes viewers on a journey bringing to life the rich history of Black spirituality through Sunday sermon and song. Gates talks with clergymen, scholars, and singers about their connection to this African-American art form of prayer and praise that also embraces elements of blues and jazz. New Orleans is known around the globe as the cradle of jazz, and we caught up with singer Charmaine Neville, daughter of the late Charles Neville of the famed Neville Brothers, to find out how gospel music informed her musical career. Charmaine, welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Thank you so much for having me. I was really excited when I got the call that you wanted me to come.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
If you would, take us back in time to your early days.
Oh, what my goodness.
What was it like hanging out on gigs with your dad, Charles Neville, and his brothers? What were the musical sounds that you heard, and how did that make you feel?
Well, it was all phenomenal. You know, first of all, working with my dad, you know, And of course, with the Neville brothers, you know, I loved all of them. And we did different things together, but it was mostly my father. He and I did so many things together where he played in my band, I played with his band, you know, and different things like that. But it all started, you know, with me as a little girl, you know, listening to other musicians in this city. And him introducing me to all of these great musicians, you know, and they were the ones who told me things, that told me stories, and, you know, that all got it started, so, you know.
Other musicians like who?
Oh, my goodness, everybody from, I'm going to say Dr. John, let's see, Mr. Google Eyes, Mr. G. I remember him, and my daddy introduced me to Danny Barker. He introduced me to everybody. I mean, Fats Domino, you know. I could name for about 8 days we'd be here, you know, talking about the people that he introduced me to, and not just local musicians, but also musicians from other parts of the world, where we went on tours together, he and I, and he would introduce me to people that I never thought I would meet, you know. And because of him, I got to sing for Nelson Mandela, to do a thing for Nelson Mandela for his birthday when he was released, you know, and I got to sing for him, and that was just pivotal for me, you know, to do that, you know. And the great people that he introduced me to just changed my life, you know, musically. So we did a tour. Wait, this was a long time ago. I got to work with Nina Simone because of my father.
Wow.
You know, I got to work with Betty Carter and Sarah Vaughan and, you know, Phoebe Snow and, you know, and Dizzy Gillespie. Dizzy Gillespie, I was walking down the street in New York and I heard somebody playing the horn. So I turned the corner and went down the street. There's this guy sitting on the stoop. And he said, "Little Charlie, Little Charlie." I said, "Oh, nobody knows my nickname. I'm in New York, you know." He said, "Oh, I know your daddy." He said, "And you're leaving to go on tour with us in a couple of weeks." And I was like, "Okay." I said, "My daddy didn't tell me about that, but it was so true."
Wow.
And that's how I got to work with Nina Simone.
And about how old were you when this was going on?
Oh, my God. I was in my 20s, early 20s.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But it was very special, you know. To be.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Why? So when were you first introduced to gospel?
I was 2 years old. And it's funny because people always say you cannot remember things when you're that young, but that's not true. I was in the Sunshine Choir at St. Joan of Arc. And I remember the choir director saying to me, "Well, this lady wants to talk to you." And I didn't know who the lady was. I just knew that she wanted to talk to me. And she said she wanted to teach me a song. And she taught me, "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child." And I had never heard that song before, but I grasped it right then and there, you know. And she pushed me out in front of the church. And I'll never forget, she had the biggest hands I had ever seen in my life. And she pushed me out in front of the church. And I sang the song, and everybody went crazy. And it wasn't until years later that I was told that it was Mahalia Jackson.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that's what I said, too. I was like, "What?" You know? But that was my first venture into gospel music. The very first was that song, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child.
And how did that song grab you?
Wow. I mean, at two, it was just something somebody asked me to sing. The thing that grabbed me was the way that everyone reacted in the church, and I knew what I was going to do for the rest of my life. I knew I was going to be a singer. Not just a singer, but an entertainer with a capital E.
Yes, indeed.
Did you at some point sing gospel in your church choir as a young adult?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because I was raised Catholic, you know, I sang in the choir and in the Catholic church, but I would always go to the Baptist churches where I had my sisters and, you know, I had many foster sisters, so, you know, and they were all in Baptist churches and they had the best choirs. So, you know, that's where I went and would sing in those church choirs and so many different churches. I can't even remember all of the names of all of them. Most of them were from the Ninth Ward, because that's where I was living, in the Lower Ninth Ward. And, you know, getting to see all kinds of people coming through the church, like Fats Domino and, you know, just all kinds of people. So, you know, and you knew who they were no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, so, and they'd be in the church. So everybody doing their praise. And, yeah, I'll never forget a lady asking me, I was on tour in Europe somewhere working with gospel choirs. And we were going to all of these different cathedrals and churches and everything, you know. And it was phenomenal. And a lady asked me, she said, well, can you teach me how to praise? I said, honey, if you don't know how to praise, there's nothing I can do for you. She said, because when I see the way that y'all are in church and you praise it and yes, that's, you feel it, you know, it's a feeling. And when that energy gets into you and you get that praise feeling, you know, it's going to happen for you. I can't teach you that. He gives it to you, you know. I worked with different gospel groups throughout my life in the city, you know.
So tell us more about that feeling. This is an uplift.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's like, you know, you feel like you're floating and you can't stop because it's taking you somewhere. You know, you're going to a different universe almost. It's like, you know, have you ever had the dream that you were flying? You know, you started walking and then all of a sudden you were running and then you were flying. It's like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly.
I know that. As you pursued a career in music, did those early experiences singing gospel music in church inform or influence your
music?
Of
course, yes.
How so?
Well, because I got to work with other great vocalists like Lady B.J. and Marva Wright, and, you know, I could name forever. And they were influencing me and helping me along the way as well. So, you know, those were days that you were developing different things, you know, and learning to become on your own. I'll never forget, three different people gave me the best information ever in my life. One was Diana Ross. She was here. She was playing at the Blue Room at the Roosevelt Hotel. And I went to try out for background singers. And she told me, she listened to me and everything. She told me, no. She said, go home. She said, because you're not a background singer. You are a lead person. She said, go home. And I did. And then I tried out again for Tina Turner. And I got to work with Tina and with Ike before he passed away. It was the last tour that I did with him before he passed away, way after Tina had left, you know. And he told me, say, you know, you're good. He said, but you're not a background singer. I said, well, I wasn't here to sing background. I was here just to sing, you know. But a lot of people have taught me, you know, told me different things and told me where to go. So all of that, you stand on everyone's shoulders to get where you're going, you know. And I know that some people have stood on my shoulders, you know. But I've loved every moment of getting to sing. I enjoy so much what I do just to make people enjoy stuff. And I mean, I've made people cry. I mean, I made Sidney Poitier cry.
Wow.
It was here in New Orleans after Katrina, the Vagina Monologues. And I did the song, Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans? And I told the whole story of how New Orleans was before I got into the song, you know. And He came up to me after the performance, and he had tears in his eyes. He said, nobody has ever made me cry except for on set when it was time for me to cry for something. He said, you made me cry. And that, and we were friends from that moment on, you know. And I loved him so, so much and got to meet his entire family, you know. I mean, who can say that? I sat in his kitchen, you know, and ate dinner with his grandfather and his uncles and his, you know, just everybody in his family. And he lived right across the street from Rita Marley. Yes, indeed.
Wow.
And I love her too, you know. Yeah.
So now you're not singing gospel in these situations,
no,
or are you?
No. No. Okay. I mean, I'm singing some gospel. I'm not saying that I was, because I take people to church every night. You know, I would do a gospel song after I'd done something else, you know. Do a lot of music and then say, okay, let's go to church, you know. Or you'd see somebody in the background in the back of the room, like the tambourine lady. You know, she'd come up on stage and then we'd do a gospel tune, you know, and she'd play. You know, you would always take them to church. There was always an episode in your performance that you would take people to church, you know. So.
And I believe that you sing in the church to this day. You sing gospel?
Yes, I do. It just depends on what church I'm going to go to, you know, for that particular day. So I'm not going to say that I belong to any church. I mean, I do belong to Our Lady of Guadalupe, you know. And they have a great choir. But, you know, every once in a while I'll sing, you know. So wherever I end up, that's where I'm going to sing for that day.
And I believe you sang recently?
Where was I? Somewhere there. Oh, at the Dewdrop across the lake. There was three different gospel choirs that were there that I performed with. It was so phenomenal. I mean, they just had all of that, just, you know, when, like we were talking about, that feeling that, oh, like he's put his hand on your head, you know, and he's just touching you and your soul and your heart and everything. And those fabulous voices of all of those people from right across the lake, just phenomenal. But gospel is the root of all of it. It all started, you know, as spirituals in the cotton fields and in the sugarcane fields, you know. It all started there. And it was a way to not worry so much about what you were going through and what you had to do. And these are stories that were told to me from, you know, ancestors, you know, who were were actual slaves, you know. And they would say, yeah, this is what we did, and this is how we got through it, you know. And they would tell you the songs. And so that's how I learned a lot of those songs, was, you know, through people telling me, okay, well, learn this song and learn this. And this is what this song means, and this is what that song means, you know. So it was phenomenal. And it's something that you never forget, and you always pass on to the young people coming up behind you. That's what I tell these young people today. The only thing you look behind you for is for someone to grab by the hand and pull them to the front with you. So that's the only thing you go back for, to bring somebody to the front.
Well, you're speaking with New Orleans singer Charmaine Neville, daughter of the late Charles Neville of the famed Neville Brothers. Now, Charmaine, you have put your stamp on the music you grew up with, a style of jazz-infused funk, would you say?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
How does gospel music continue to influence your music to this day? Tell us how it speaks to you and how you stay connected.
Well, I stay connected mainly because I have a lot of musicians who play with me, who work with me, that I work with, that are just phenomenal, and they are definitely gospel people. You know, my guitar player, Detroit Brooks, he wrote the most phenomenal gospel song, Oh Lord, We Need Thee. And he did it as a mass thing. You know, he got everybody from Irma Thomas to, you know, you name everybody who was in that choir singing that song, you know. And he's phenomenal, and I just love him so much. So he gives you a lot of the gospel, too. And so does my bass player, you know, Donald Ramsey. I know he comes from, you know, a gospel background. So all of that is infused in everything that we do. You know, we may be doing jazz, we may be doing country, we may be doing funk, we may be doing rock and roll, but the gospel is always there, you know.
How do you feel about gospel embracing secular music?
Well, I think it's a wonderful thing. I know that a lot of people back in the day, they would say, oh, no, you're not a real gospel singer because you sing that other stuff, you know. But it didn't affect me that way, so it didn't change me.
As gospel music continues to evolve, how do you see it moving into the future for younger generations? And why is it important that it continues
to evolve? It has to continue. Everything evolves. Everything changes. It's never going to leave us. The gospel should never leave anything. It has to continue to evolve and go into these young people and show them what's next in life.
Can you give us an example? Can you sing us out showing us how you interweave gospel Ooh. In your own music?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many songs. Now you really put me on the spot. Okay. I think I've got it. This is a song that a long time ago, wow, I just thought about it. And I think who first taught me this song was probably my daddy. And I remember the first time I saw him in his navy whites with the bell bottoms, and he was standing in the door, and he told me these words. Now you're going to make me cry. I'm sorry. Wait. Can we wait a minute? Because I'm thinking about him, and I'm sorry. I can't even remember the song now. Oh, my goodness. Where's my handkerchief?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I was not intending to make you cry.
I know you weren't. Oh, I know. And I'm not blaming it on you, but I can't find a handkerchief. Oh, my gosh. Here it is. But there's so many songs, you know. And this is not a gospel song, but it is a song that I can make be gospel because it has so many things that makes you feel like, you know, you can just be anywhere and do anything, you know. And it's an old song, and it's by Louis Armstrong. He definitely had a gospel thing going on, you know. All of me. One part of doing all of me, when I get to a certain part of it, I change it, and I bring it to a big swing, and then I bring it back down and bring it to a gospel thing. So, but it's just the song All of Me. All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see? Ah, no good without you. You took the part that really once was my heart. Now, why not take all of, skibbidi-bop, babbidi-bop, do-bop-do. And then I'd go into all of me. Why not take all of me? I said, can't you see? I'm no good without you. Well, you know, he took and gave me the part that really once was my heart. Why not take all of skibbity bobbity bibbity bobbity bit do bop hee? So infusing the two, the three, the four.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
New Orleans jazz singer Charmaine Neville, it's been fun talking with you.
Thank you.
The PBS docuseries Gospel, hosted by Harvard scholar, executive producer, and writer Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr., is currently airing on your local PBS station. More information is online at pbs.org. WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. You've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Diane Maddock. Thanks to our guest, reporter Drew Hawkins from the Gulf States Newsroom and New Orleans jazz singer Charmaine Neville. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Today's episode was produced by Matt Bloom and Audrey Procell and was engineered by Garrett Pittman. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcast.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation.